Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are going to discuss murder, mayhem, and riverboats.
Nice.
So, yeah, in other words, we're here not to discuss
riverboats,
not to discuss Mark Twain, but instead to discuss Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile. We're going to discuss chapters 11 through 20. So, basically, the murder section and the beginning of the investigation and the pearls getting thrown onto the table. That's where this section will end. Mrs. Bowers throws the pearls onto the table. Not pearls before swine.
No. Pearls before a detective.
The detective.
The detective.
So, Tim, you didn't get to be with us
right
last time. But, you know, speaking of mysteries and so forth, there's no mystery as to where you were because
right.
you were in Aruba.
Right.
But if history shows us anything, it's that mysterious things happen.
Anything
when you are
can
in
happen
Aruba.
In Aruba.
Yes.
So we need to know, how was Aruba? Did any mysteries happen? Did any strange occurrences befall you while you were on vacation in Aruba?
No, it was, I started to say hapless, but that's not right. Like someone can be hapless.
Without hap? What is hap?
That's what I was just about to like explore that mystery. What is hap?
Just going to Google,
okay,
what is
okay.
hap?
Do you know what? I bet we know. No, I bet we don't. I was going to say hapless. Is that an abbreviation for happening? So someone
well,
who is
it's probably
hapless?
Like a etymology. Hap is a root, right? Happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happiness. I don't know. David's looking it up.
Haberdashery?
No, haberdashery.
Haberdashery, right?
Two different.
Haberdashery. No, I'm sure it's happer.
No.
So hapless literally means what you'd expect it to mean without hap. Hap being another word for fortune or luck. Hap derives from the old Norse word for good luck, a word that is also the source of our happen and happy. English has several words to describe those lacking good fortune, including ill-starred, ill-fated, unlucky, and luckless, a word formed in parallel to hapless by adding the suffix less.
Yes, got that.
Great. Let's see here.
So it sounds like I'm right, though, about haberdashery.
14th century.
Haberdashery.
I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. 14th century.
We're educated people that read stuff.
She
I didn't know
Heidi
about
was
that.
Like shutting that one down. Tim.
I know. She's just not having it.
So, Tim, nothing befell you then?
No. We stayed. I'm going to tell you one thing. And it wasn't like any great mystery or anything, but we stayed in this beautiful big Airbnb at kind of an elevated part of the island. Aruba is not big at all, like maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 miles top to toe. And on December 31st, we all had dinner on our kind of like outdoor elevated veranda. And we had been seeing people buy fireworks all day, huge fireworks displays, everybody stopping in and getting fireworks. So we knew there was going to be some fireworks. Oh my goodness. We had no idea. At 11:59, the fireworks started going off and literally there was not a foot on the horizon that was not exploding. It looked like, what do they call it when the U.S. invaded Iraq, the whole shock and awe treatment? I'm not kidding. It really did look like that. It was incredible. It was incredible. But that was the sum total of the haps.
The haps.
Yeah, the haps on Aruba.
It's the opposite of ill-starred.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Ah, that
well
was nice.
I would call it well-starred.
Myriad stars.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be a segue here. I'm coming up.
I have nothing, though. So I'm just waiting on you, David.
So no Instagram.
There are no Instagram models that approached me.
Which is so
which is surprising.
Yeah, I know. Honestly, given my experience walking around towns with you, such as in Charleston or Charlotte or wherever, I would have thought that anywhere you go, the
right.
models right. are walking up to you.
Right, right. And introducing
Heidi
themselves.
Heidi just made the most.
What, David? Come on.
Skeptical face.
No,
I've seen her make that, or it's a migraine.
I missed that. Heidi, when David said, it's just like Tim, that like whenever we're in a big city, a model
walk around towns
and
together.
And you
yeah.
were giving a skeptical look?
No.
I don't think she meant to. You know, I don't know if she meant to.
Misinterpreted
I don't know if she meant to.
I was probably nodding along with that. Mm-hmm. I actually have been in towns with you when women have approached you. So
actually, that's true. I'm being serious.
This is not an unusual hap.
It's not.
It could be. Sometimes it could be hapless, though.
Sometimes it could. Yeah, it could.
It could be ill-starred.
I remember one day I was approached while wearing some fashionable headgear that I bought at the Haberdashery, and
Haberdashery.
Haps ensued.
By headgear, do you mean like your headgear for your braces?
Right. You get that at the orthodont app.
Yeah, the orth. Tim was wandering around downtown Atlanta in 1984 with his headgear, and models were just flocking.
Exactly.
Salmon of Capistrano, to borrow the Dumb and Dumber line.
Oh,
I somehow feel this is
my
gone.
My day is so much better.
This is somehow gone from...
You're kind of like the Lynette Doyle of the group.
Well done.
So what does that mean about what's going to happen, I don't know, midway through this episode?
At some point, every metaphor falls apart, but we'll just see what point that is for this story.
It at least holds on as a segue. Yeah, well, this episode is becoming hapless. We are here to discuss... Truly, for those of you who stuck around this long, we are here to discuss Death on the Nile. And Tim, you weren't here for the first episode, so we got to do a little bit of remedial work with you here.
Yeah.
This is your first time reading this book, right?
First time.
Okay, so I want to start here. I think we got to give the people what they want.
Yeah.
It's time for a Tim prediction, a Tim prophecy.
Yeah, it's predictions. It's prediction time.
A Tim prophecy.
Tim.
Predict him. And you now know, you're two-thirds of the way through this book.
Yeah.
You know who is dead. You know that the jewels have been placed on the table.
For a second, David? Did you guys know that Lynette Ridgway, Nay Ridgway, was dead like from the opening sentence of the book?
Well, the back of the book says the tranquility of a cruise along the Nile was shattered by the discovery that Lynette Ridgway had been shot through the head.
Okay. But I'm just... Sometimes I don't read the blurbs, but you knew she was a goner,
you see
right?
It coming a mile away.
Yeah.
And okay. Christy's not trying to hide that, I don't think.
No, I don't think
it is interesting. Well, we'll talk about this. Okay, so let's do a predict him, and we have been given the beginning of the investigation. Poirot and Race have begun gathering facts. They've even done a summary for us. Right about halfway through the book, they dropped a summary into the proceedings to help us get bearings on what has been done so far. Helpful there by Dame Agatha Christie to just drop us a little summary midway through. But Tim, knowing what you know from that summary and your own keen sense of observation and your prophetic powers.
Yeah.
Tim, who do you believe killed Lynette Doyle? Ridgway Doyle.
Okay.
Let's talk through it. Let's work through this a little.
Okay.
But you have to use a Belgian accent.
I can't do a Belgian accent. Okay, let's start with the red herring. The most obvious red herring is Jackie Belfour. She's so clearly not the murderer. because she, everything about her says she should be the murderer. We know we have enough information that she is not the murderer. So that's our number one red herring. It seems to me like a crime writer as sophisticated as Agatha Christie might have, in this case, a second red herring. That second red herring, for me is Simon Doyle, because he seems like, I don't trust him. All right. Mm-hmm. I don't trust him.
Mm-hmm.
He's willing to drop Jackie. And I think that even before he was involved with Jackie, I have a feeling he was like angling for somebody better. That's my hunch. We don't,
you
get
just don't
that
trust
in
that
the
guy.
Backstory. I just don't trust him. Right. Okay. But he is also so obviously, kind of sinister and hungry for money that he seems too obvious a candidate to be a murderer. So I think he's the second red herring. And now it seems to me like everybody else is basically vying for the place, for third place. And whoever finishes in third place actually ends up being in first place. They're the murderer. I'm really skeptical of Andrew Pennington. He just looks so, I don't know. I don't trust that guy either. We're supposed to, who's the communist? I've got him written down.
Yeah. Heidi,
Ferguson.
You should.
It's Ferguson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ferguson, I think there's no way. I don't understand why he would. He's just detestable. He's just so he's like seemly and unappealing. And I feel like Agatha Christie is enough of a traditionalist that she's just like, all the other traditionalists are going to be like, ooh, communists. They murder people. They murder capitalists like Lynette. He's a threat. I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay. And so the other, I'm going to reveal who I think it actually is. The other, I was paying really close attention when the lawyer wanted Lynette to sign those papers and she started reading them very closely. And the lawyer was like, no, we can do this later. Let's not, you don't need to complete this because, you know, she's paying attention. She's reading. I think the lawyer is up to something. Okay. All that being said, I actually think it's the second red herring. I actually think it's Simon Doyle. And I think that he is double crossing both Lynette and Jackie. And he was willing to take a bullet for it.
Mm. So he's trying to draw out the rage of Jackie to lead us off the scent.
I think that he's in it with Jackie. Okay. Shoot me, but not anywhere fatally. But I think that he's going to try to kind of like, he's the one who's trying to set her up to take the fall. He gets all the money.
Mm. Okay.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay. So that's,
I'm reading your faces and I'm not seeing. That's the official Macintosh line.
We're not going to give it away one way or the other. What do you want us to do?
Well, the sleuth in
nod
me,
but say no,
or what? Poker face, poker face.
It's not just you, Tim. There's people who are listening who are parsing out their reading. I mean, there's like three of them, but still.
I think there's four and a half.
Four and a half people.
Who's
who
the half?
A young child sitting in the back seat of
is half a person
of
Tim
Jesse
McIntosh.
Brown. No, a full person, but in our like podcast, whatever
for our statistic,
for our statistics,
or maybe it's an average.
It's an average.
There's three in one family and five in the other. Or I don't know. The third four, you know, even that doesn't work. Math is hard. Okay. So you think that it's Simon and Jackie
mm-hmm.
in the library mm-hmm. with the lead
with
pipe.
The revolver.
Oh yeah. Right. Okay. All right. Interesting. We're going to file that one away. The predict him.
As soon as I say it, I'm like, I don't know that Jackie actually has like the savvy to pull that off. Cause I kind of believe her rage. Her rage is believable to me. I think she's genuinely pissed off at Simon. So if Simon is going to pull a double cross, he has the everything relies on Jackie not shooting to kill.
Mm. So he has to trust her not to either not to be inept or not to be full of rage.
Right.
So, okay, one question that Heidi and I talked about last week was who our favorite characters are, like who we find most compelling. Yeah. So for you, who do you find, who do you like the best? Or do you not like as in, you know, this person would be my friend, but
right.
most compelling as a character.
Poirot is awesome, right? But he's kind of like,
yeah, okay, like
the whole book the is built to like him. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I'm looking through my cast. My cast. I don't know. I kind of like Tim Allerton a little bit, even though I find him kind of skeezy. I kind of like him.
Mm-hmm. He probably also was walking around Aruba getting approached by models.
Probably. I like name. Lynette. I like the deceased Lynette. She seems a little bit. Okay. Yeah.
What well, did you that was going to be Lynette? That was going to be a question that I had.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk about Lynette.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
This is kind of our last chance to do so. She's now gone, but she carries so much of the weight of the first half of the book. If you didn't know, like if the blurb on the back didn't say, or you didn't know it was a murder mystery, you could easily have been duped into thinking that it's this sort of, she's being followed, she's being haunted. Poirot's going to try to figure out who's bugging her.
Yeah.
But then she dies and it becomes a murder mystery. So what do we think of her? Like, are we sad when she's gone? Like, does her death carry the weight that it needs to for the book? How do you feel about Lynette Ridgway Doyle?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the reasons why this book is makes Agatha Christie, you know, the queen of crime is because the victim is there. All eyes are on her, but there's multiple interpretations of her. I don't think any woman is going to like Lynette Doyle that much.
Heidi, how come?
Because she's too perfect, which is directly alluded to in the book. She's like aspirational, like every she's, And when I say too perfect, I want to be clear because I can already hear women over drinks arguing with me about this.
She's not perfect. She's flawed.
Because they don't like her. So right, they're going to argue, right? So she's aspirational, not in a moral sense, but in like a venal sense. Like she's beautiful. She's rich. She's smart. She's capable. She's, you know, every woman, she's kind of like the ideal woman, but without enough moral weight to her to make her like likable as a person, you know, like she has all the outside trappings. So there's already multiple motives for her death in all of the characters, which is interesting. Psychologically, right? Like you could have, you know, Andrew Pennington would have a valid motive, but it would be totally different from Jackie Belafort, right? Like, but they're both valid. And they're both enough to kill this woman who has no idea she has an enemy in the world and thinks that she's living the dream. And that I think is a victory on Agatha Christie's part. But what's interesting is that all those motives come down to envy. All of them, every one of them. And I think that's kind of the one of the geniuses of this particular story is like the question mark of like, what does it mean? What does it cost you to be an object of envy in multiple perspectives? So, yeah, I think that she's a character that carries the weight, but not because you like her.
Yeah.
It's because you're envious of her.
Yeah. Everybody wants what she's got.
She's an object of desire in so many ways. Like, and from what she has to who she is, to her position, to her.
Yeah. Her reputation.
Yeah.
And we talked last week about how it makes so much sense for the movie for Kenneth Branagh and his team to cast Gal Gadot who is mm-hmm. like, she played Wonder Woman, right? Like she's the kind of person who's going to be like on People Magazine, sexiest woman of the world type things, right? She's got, it's not just
she's
that.
She's like, rich, she's beautiful, right. She's famous, she has it's social not,
it's
status,
It's not just
right?
that like, she's like yeah. an actress who's beautiful, it's that she is like one of the most recognizable women in the world at this point. Just, you know, 10-year-olds know who she is and 50-year-olds know who she is, right? And it makes so much sense to cast her in that role. Because you have to have someone who, for the audience, you have to, it's like a surrogate for the relationship with the audience. Like it takes you, you don't have to do all the character work, which is tough to do in an hour and 45 minute
right.
crime, because the audience has a relationship with her. So like there's a subconscious, like a subtle subconscious bit of character work being done just by who you cast, which is one of those things that movies can pull off in a way that other art forms really can't. Like you can use the reputation of the person who you choose to create character depth mm-hmm. or relationship with the audience.
Have you guys struggled to keep the characters distinct other than like maybe like the 5-6 main characters?
I think all the men run together a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, other than like Poirot and Doyle.
Right.
At least in terms of their names.
Yeah. I made a cheat sheet in which I wrote down everyone's names and kind of like a brief blurb
about
them.
Look at you.
Them.
That's usually stuff I do. You did
that.
I'm
learning from you.
I'm so proud of you.
I'm learning from you.
Yeah. This is so great. And what did you put? Give us a little peek onto your cheat sheet.
I'm finding that my cheat sheet is a little bit lackluster, like Mr. Gaston Blondin, restaurant owner. I'm like, okay, sure. That's that's who he is. But that isn't like, none of like
maybe you didn't need to put him on there.
It's not who he is, right. Fleetwood, engineer on the Karnak. Okay, great. But we need, it's like when you're doing sleuth work, you need, as Perot has instructed us, you guys, you need like to look inside. It needs to be in like facts about their interior
so
life.
Earnest right now. I love everything you're saying.
Well, the thing is, I was thinking about how there's two different kinds of sleuth work that happens when you read the best crime novels, right? The ones where you, like that we really trust to be great.
Yeah.
On the one hand, you've got the sleuth work that the detective is doing. So there's Poirot's sleuth work, and the novel has to set up his work. So it has to set up the clues to be there. You know, there's been all kinds of essays and books written about what makes a great detective novel. But the elements have to be there for the detective to sleuth out the sleuthable sleuthings. Then you also have the clues for the reader to do their own stuff aside from what the detective is telling them.
Yeah.
And that's where a mediocre detective novel that just sort of like lays it all out for you is set, like, this is sets it apart from that because the reader, the author creates a process or the fun or the work for the reader to do too. So I was thinking about how usually that's reading between the lines, right? Like the detective is doing the not reading between the lines. I mean, they're reading between the lines that they see, but then they're telling you what they see. And so for the reader, it's not between the lines. It's right out there. But then as readers, we can look at the way a character acts, right? Or the way they carry themselves or something subtle. Like there was something about Fanthorpe I kept thinking about in the way that she was presenting him, that it seemed like she was trying to draw our eyes to something unusual about him. And as soon as in a crime novel you're drawn to something unusual, they become a suspect, even if it's subconsciously for the reader.
Right.
And the subconscious is what makes a mystery fun, right? Because the clues that are obvious, that becomes a puzzle. But all the tone and the mood and the really fun stuff that keeps you turning all the pages is in the subtle subconscious stuff that you don't exactly know how it's working and what you're looking for and all that. And I think she's really good at that.
Okay, I have a question. At this point in the novel, 2/3 through, does Poirot know who did it? And he's just like now backtracking to kind of confirm what he's already pretty strongly convinced of.
How many Poirot mysteries have you read?
This is number two.
It's not a trick question. Okay. Yeah. He will usually tell you that in the reveal.
Wait, hold on. What?
He'll tell you when he knew.
Yeah.
You've only read two?
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to be cool too.
I feel like this podcast has become the Persecute Tim podcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, but sometimes you deserve it.
First you deny that models approach me on the street. Okay.
I know that you, David, made the statement. You made
a face, Heidi. A face. Right?
Speaking of subconscious, I can neither confirm nor deny
the faces I might have at any given time could be related to anything.
She doesn't even know the faces that she makes.
And then after you make that
face, like my children.
After you make that face, you said, and I quote, "How many Poirot novels have you even read?"
Even. I did not say even. That how many completely have changes you even the sentence.
Read?
Well, she didn't say even, but I'm kind of saying you've only read two.
Yeah.
So this one and Murder on the Orient Express?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. This might actually, I might not even try to hide this becoming a Persecute Tim.
No. I'm not even mad. I'm impressed that you've avoided it for so long.
Yeah. I mean, I think you should probably read more.
So. Like, just full stop. You should just read more.
Period.
Do you not like mysteries in general?
Or do generally you just not, speaking, I don't.
Do you not like or do you not prioritize?
I don't prioritize.
That's a good question.
I don't prioritize. I will tell
you're
you.
You're a serious reader.
Right. I love.
I'm reading 900 page tomes on Catherine the Great.
The Catherine the Great.
Economics of 17th century Russian farming.
How many Tolstoys have you even read,
Ivy? Okay, look. Dostoevsky, Crime and Punishment is a murder mystery in which you know who committed the murder. You don't know why he did it.
It's true. We did talk about this on the Patreon.
Yeah.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite books also, I think, qualifies as a murder mystery. The Secret History by Donna Tartt. You know in the first whatever chapter who did it. And you want to know why they did it. For some reason, I find that mode very appealing.
Yeah, because okay, it's less the story of a murder just tell you and more the that story Poirot of a murderer. Did this one?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, Heidi. So, okay, is this the way that Poirot, like, does he always know fairly early on who did it?
No, not always.
Not always.
But a lot of what, so much of what's compelling about an Agatha Christie is when there's a reveal, there's always a twist. There's always a surprise. There's whether or not it's Poirot's, sleuthing, something will come out and they'll say, I knew at this point, but I didn't know how this was accomplished in order to do them. I was stumped by the closed door or the light switch and then something will fall into place that he'll be able to handle, all of the details.
There's no questions. Yeah.
Yeah.
DA has to make a case.
Right. Yeah. And he won't speak until he's sure and, all that kind of thing.
Yeah. But
it's also, I think, about the experience of the reader. Mm-hmm. So like Poirot is your guide. Like that's why halfway through the book he summarizes in this case. Mm-hmm. And so then it's giving us our bearings to start thinking, okay, this is what we know so far.
Yeah.
But just what we know actually true. And like, how is that going to?
Yeah.
How does that impact this other thing? So, it is kind of a brain teaser in some ways.
Yeah.
But and I don't think all of them are like that.
Right. Well, and some of her novels have this like wide range. Like, some of them are about the puzzle. Some of them are about the psychology. Some of them are about kind of an exploration of a bigger question like justice or love or,
Some don't have a detective at all.
Right. And some are like more adventure stories. And there's so many of them. And she has a capacity for a wide range. I would say for her, I'm not sure where I would put this one, like the puzzle's pretty good, but there are others that are just in terms of the actual clue making sleuthing, there's some that are a little bit more complex and have that, like, you know, by the time the reveal is, it just feels like this, the multiple threads having been thrown out come together in this like very satisfying, surprising, complex puzzle kind of way. And I think there are others of hers that meet that criteria a little more than this one. This one is I think more of a psychological study, but all of them have the elements of each, you know.
So, you know, the Chrissy's birthday was just this week, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And so I went back and looked at the thing that, you know, Heidi, you and me and Sean Johnson and Ian and Emily Andrews for Forma, we put together a list. I'm like, I guess it was the 100th anniversary of her birthday back in 2000. We posted this in 2020. 130th anniversary of her birthday. And we did a top 20 of her novels. And we collectively, you know, we had a process for this, but we had And Then There Were None first, which doesn't have a detective. It doesn't have Poirot or Marple.
Oh, really?
Like this one, it's like there's a psychological thriller element to it that I think her best books have. But back to this book, Heidi, did you say everything you wanted to say about Lynette?
Tim? I did, yeah.
Okay. So Tim, did you want to talk about Lynette? Like, were you sad? I mean, you said you saw it coming, but were you like, you would come to care about this person or
no
something?
No, I don't know. I feel like she was kind of.
Were you happy?
I wasn't happy. Good I think riddance. I knew she was gone. She was a goner, seriously, from the first sentence when they describe, you know, like how when Christy describes how great she is, I'm like, oh yeah, she's dead. She's dead. Yeah. It's just a matter of time.
She's either going to do the killing or she's dead.
Right. And she was kind of like maybe morally vacant more than she was. I mean, Heidi kind of alluded to this. She's everything that you would kind of want to possess, but very little in terms of what you would admire.
So this far given what you're saying here, we're this far into the book. It seems like for so much of the first, say at least third of the book up to the first half, she is like carrying a lot of the dramatic weight of the book, but she's dead. So the book can't really be carried by her.
Yeah.
Poirot doesn't really carry the books, like the psychological weight of the books. He like solves a clue for us. So who is this book's real beating heart, do you think? Like, who is the character, or what is the, I don't know how you want to put it, like that is driving the action, that's like driving the empathy and the pathos and keeping us reading, besides just, this is a clue that I want to know the answer to, because like just wanting to know the answer to a clue, it's not that big of a deal. We can Wikipedia that, right? So what keeps us reading the actual book? If you can't be Lynette.
Jackie.
Yeah, I agree.
It's Jackie.
100%.
It's Jackie and her loss and her longing and her naked emotion, as it's called in the novel. And that the sympathy that we have as readers with her plight.
Yeah. I love the, the little lecture from the Old Testament that Poirot gives.
I love Poirot. He's just the best.
Right?
He's such a humanitarian.
And I think, aren't we supposed to walk away from that, having a lower view of Lynette? Certainly of Simon, right? Mm-hmm. But I think when Lynette gets lectured by Poirot, like I was like, yeah, Lynette, come on. It's not just like you have your pick. Jackie did not have her pick of men. You have your pick of men, and you went to your best friend and you took her guy? Like, come on. Come on. And what, you know, Lynette's reply, you know, like the heart chooses what the heart wants or something like that. You're like, well, okay, right. But I think that we're deliberately supposed to think less of Lynette, and maybe the pang of her loss doesn't really hurt so much. What really hurts is Jackie's loss. And what is that setting us up for?
It's interesting that we are like, we almost feel in opposition to Lynette when she dies. Like normally you'd have this character who, whoever dies, they either die off stage at the beginning, you barely know about them. They're like the Lord of the Manor or something. But we spend half the book with this character and then we don't like them. And then she dies and we're supposed to figure out how to care about it. I think it's interesting that Christy asks us of that.
I don't know if she, I think we are, to go back to your earlier question, then I think we are supposed to not like Lynette. I think she's intended to create a dissonance in the reader of she has everything. And yet except for substance, except for humanity, except for compassion, like she has everything, but she is nothing. Right. Mm. And that, like, she's so empty as a person. And so I don't think we're supposed to feel like she deserves it because she's so oblivious. There are other less sympathetic murder victims in the Christy canon, that, you know, even Murder on the Orient Express, right? He's probably, Ratchet's probably the least sympathetic, like the most wicked.
He's like a genuinely bad guy.
Yes. And there's a couple others like that. But Lynette is not, she's not cruel or heartless, but she's careless because she's so fortunate, because she's so, you know, hapt, I guess.
Good callback.
Yes. And that has made her careless, and this is a big theme in Christie's work. Carelessness does as much damage as cruelty. That's a huge theme in Agatha Christie's canon. That to be a careless person does an immense amount of damage, and maybe even more than cruelty, because cruelty is at least targeted towards something, and it usually there's an element of deservedness, at least, you know, to revenge. But with carelessness, you just go out into the world and wreak havoc and you have no idea. Yeah. And that's what Lynette Doyle is doing. But Jackie has something, like she has this capacity to love that is now thwarted. And what I really, you know, Agatha Christie, whenever she gets in these like kind of like deep psychological modes in her stories, which I really like that about her. That's what makes her my favorite mystery writer, is that she does this kind of thing that's a little bit like Flannery O'Connor in Mystery and Manners, when Flannery O'Connor intentionally says there's this veneer of manners that we have and we need it. It's what civilization is. But underneath that is the natural man, so to speak. Underneath that is always this like surging tide of emotion that that's what O'Connor is interested in. And she does this in a totally different way than Agatha Christie. And as a craftsman, there's no competition. Like as an actual author, like the words on a page, Flannery O'Connor wins by a mile. But it's the same kind of exploration of the soul.
Yeah.
It's like underneath the manners, there is this mystery. And that is what makes people, that comes out. And that's what murder is. Like, according to Agatha Christie, that's why it happens, is because when people can no longer contain the mystery with the manners, somebody dies. And so it becomes this exploration of the natural man. And Jackie is our natural man, so to speak, in terms of the phrase of that. Jackie's the one that is like, that is pure naked emotion.
The mask is off.
Yes. And Poirot has so much sympathy for that. And he becomes her defender and her advocate. But he can't stop, you know, that he can't necessarily protect her from Simon and Lynette's marriage, right? Mm-hmm, and that
yeah, he can't protect her emotionally or whatever.
Yeah, that creates this pathos within the story. But he's the one who sees her. That's what I like about Perot, is he sees people. He pays attention, he sees people and acts accordingly.
Yeah, it's like this dissonance gets introduced and then that leads to the disorder that leads to the murder.
Right.
And then it's up to Poirot, along with us as the readers, to restore the order.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like there's a dissonance and a disorder. There's a dissonance that leads to a disorder that then the book is about that restoration.
Right.
And so we, as the readers, are like longing for that. We feel the dissonance, then the crime happens, and then we're participating in trying to get that cathartic reordering at the end.
Right.
You guys, there's this show on Netflix called Love on the Spectrum. Have you heard about Love on the Spectrum?
No.
I've heard about it.
It's a story. It's like multiple stories of younger people who are on the autism spectrum trying to find romance. And Galen turned me on to it. It is such a great show. And the reason that it's so great is for like the reasons that you're describing, Heidi, the way that we feel about Jackie. It's like her emotions are laid bare. She no longer cares about kind of like remaining civil and like keeping up the manners. That's how these kids feel as they like go on these dates. It is so intense because the way that you feel, you know, like when you were dating, or maybe like the way that you still feel with your spouse when you're frustrated or swept up in love, it's all laid completely bare in these dates. It's so intense that it's almost, for me, it's almost unwatchable. It is so intense. And it made me really think like, oh yeah.
Worst episodes of The Office where Michael Scott does something exactly. That's like so awkward.
It's so awkward. It's just
right.
Like,
it makes you cringe. Like you want to shy yeah. away from it. Put back the manners. Put on the manners.
Please, we must yeah. have manners.
Yeah. The mystery is too much.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it is. It's, yeah.
Well, and that's why like these stories being told in the context of this British sense of order is compelling and has made them last. You know, she's
right.
responding to and like helping like recreate this disorder in a world that is like all about order.
Mm.
It's right. like the people, like order is outlet. Its defining characteristic practically.
Yeah.
Right.
So to introduce the dissonance then becomes a pretty profound action.
So there is an element of like satire, of social satire mm-hmm. within Agatha Christie, and a little bit of an indictment of that kind of repression that permeates yeah. British mm-hmm. culture. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it seems like every era or sort of subgenre of mystery writing and crime writing has some version of this. Like there's a whole bunch of 1930s, 40s, 50s Los Angeles crime novels, Ross McDonald and John D. McDonald and those kind of guys. That's like they're very American. They're not like there's not really a lot of order to begin with. And that's kind of the one of the points is like people are scrambling to the crimes often happen because people are scrambling to survive. You know, that's part of what makes them psychologically deep. Usually the person who commits the crime, even if it's a crime of passion, is like from the streets of LA and, you know, or from the valley or, you know, something like that. And they're not occasionally, you know, like they're in the big sleep, they're somewhat rich and their daughter gets swept up on something they shouldn't. And then the sister tries to rescue them and weird things happen. And the private detective has to go about solving it. But a lot of times it's just like an average person struggling to survive in early 20th century America, you know, mid 20th century America, in like this burgeoning city where crime is on the rise and all that, as opposed to these British landed gentry, you know, lords and ladies and crimes that happen in English estates and on golf courses and with vicars, yeah. you know. And it seems like every genre has their own sort of particular, I guess, version of what we're talking about. And then that means that the detectives, the people who solve the crimes, are their own, fit that mode too. So, you know, you got like a Sam Spade. He's a little cynical. He's maybe a World War I vet. He's got like, he's like dark and, you know, he wears a, he's like kind of not trustworthy, but he's really good at his job. He smokes way too much. He's like, his eyebrows are not kempt, that's for sure. He doesn't speak very properly. Like everything is the
Did
opposite
of Did you just say his eyebrows are not kempt?
Unkempt. His eyebrows are unkempt.
I love that. That's great. I love that.
So he's everything, you know, Poirot is the perfect detective for this, the right. order that he's yeah. trying to restore in that particular world.
He's
because
punctilious in
he's
a way.
He's punctilious.
That,
yeah.
Bourgeois, whereas, like, she always says.
Yeah, he's exactly. Not
a, yeah.
He's, she calls him bourgeois?
Yes.
Oh, really?
He's a bougie detective trying to restore a bougie order to a bougie culture.
Do you, yeah. Was that, that word now is so, for me, associated with the juxtaposition with the proletariat. And the
it is in Christie too.
Oh, is yeah. it really?
Yeah, she kind of like mocks him even a little bit. She gives him this moral center, but he's like, she's a funny lady, and she mocks him a little bit for being bourgeois, but he's an outsider coming into the inside of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
So he occupies a really interesting space socially in her books. But yeah. So, I like that.
Well, it's hard to talk too much more without talking about the ending. So, Tim, when you actually finished the book and then made your prediction, or
no. No, of course not. That, wait, does that mean I got it right?
No, I'm just throwing red herrings at you.
I obviously don't feel super strongly about my second red herring is the true murderer theory, because I'm like, so what's the deal with a huge boulder that kind of like topples and almost falls on Lynette? Like, how do you explain
that? And we know
that?
Jackie didn't do that.
We know that Jackie didn't do that. So, okay. Can I just like throw out my second theory is that it has something to do with her estate and her lawyers. Great, Tim. That's really helpful. Like, that's nice and broad, right?
You want to just keep listing people as possible?
Yeah, by the time I can go back in the last episode and be like, see, I was right. I suspected them the whole time.
There's also all these other like sub mysteries to the book, right? Like, there, what's up with Rosalie Otterburn, and what's mm-hmm. like all these like interesting kind of, and who is Fanthrop?
And Mrs. Bowers and the pearls
and, you know, which one in Cornelia, which one is she, which man is she going to pick? And
yeah.
What's up with Ferguson? Like, there's all these little sub mysteries and we're not sure which of those sub mysteries has something to do with Lynette or is a red herring or has something else that's coming within the story. Yeah. So, and I think that, you know, as you pointed out, David, there's kind of those, all of those help keep the reader interested in guessing and trying to solve the puzzle, and we don't know what's a clue and what isn't a clue, and
you know, no yeah. one ever predicts when they do these predictions that it's going to be that it's the old lady that can barely move
right. or the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah.
Yeah, the old lady who can't move. She's a stock character in Agatha Christie too, and sometimes she's real and sometimes she's not, so.
All right, Tim.
All right, David.
You're back from Aruba.
Yep. Back in the saddle.
You're going to finish your second Agatha Christie book. Hold on for the ride.
Yep.
See if we'll find out if you were right.
Yep.
How right you were. Is there a degree to which you were right?
Yep. That's an interesting possibility.
When it turns out it's Fanthrop and Pennington
right.
together.
Or Ferguson. It is the communist after all.
Yeah.
Up with the proletariat, down with the bourgeoisie.
Exactly. It's right there in front of us all along.
Right there in front of us all along.
All right. Well, Heidi, anything you want to add before we before we go? All right. Well, Tim, thanks for joining us again. Thanks for actually coming to the podcast. We appreciate you making a token appearance.
Yeah, I came and I took my bludgeoning from you guys.
Well, I mean, you're not going to show up. You're going to get bludgeoned every now and then.
Your skin got thin over the last couple weeks.
Did.
You've been in Aruba.
He's been in that, room in sunshine.
Right.
All right. Well,
it's probably all the supermodels telling you how amazing you are.
Probably.
Exactly.
Is.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, for Tim McIntosh and his supermodels and for Heidi White, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, happy reading.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.